Okay.
Good afternoon. Members, please have your seats. I call Human Services Finance Committee to order. Well, thank you. We have a quorum present, and I just wanted to begin with the approval of minutes for April 9, 2024. Vice Chair Barney.
I would be delighted to approve the minute or move the minutes for April 9th, 2024.
Vice Chair Vanna moves the approval of minutes of April 9th, 2024. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes for April 9th, 2024 are now adopted. With that, we do have a few bills, and the first bill is my bill, House File 4360. I move House File 4360. And I'll be switching the chairs with Vice Chairman.
We'll give the chair a moment to settle in. All right, and we have some more folks who have joined us. So then we're going to start with House File, 4360. Chair Noor, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I moved already the bill, I do have a DE1 for the bill, Madam Chair.
All right. And would you like us to speak to that first, or would you like us to adopt it and then speak to the bill as a whole?
This DE1 puts the bill in the shape that I want for the bill. So
right.
I think we can have the conversation on the DE1 with the adoption of the bill complete.
Perfect. We will move the chair moves the DE1 to put the bill in the shape he would like it. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay. The ayes have it. Mr. Chair, the bill is now in the shape you would like it. If you'd like to go ahead and speak to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think we need to have a little bit of a background of how the case management really works. Counties are responsible to do the case management for waiver programs, targeted case management, as required by law. However, this bill requires that if a county provides case management under contracts, that means they're providing case management through external entities, this will now require them, as they all do, a competitive RFP process for transparency purposes, for making sure that we do have qualified individuals who are able to provide the case management on behalf of the counties. Some of the counties, they don't use any contracted case management, but there are few who use contracted case management. What this bill will do is will require the counties for every 2 years to open up RFP competitive process for them to be able to pick and choose those who are qualified to do the work of case management. So this is a simple proposal to make sure that we do have fairness, we do have transparency, we have a system in place for the counties to do this work. And that's all we're doing with the DE1, Madam Chair, members.
All right, thank you, Chair Noor. And I do not see any testifiers here in the room, on the list. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? Please come down, state your name for the record and your affiliation, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, Chair Noor. My name is Matt Freeman. I am the Executive Director for the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators. I want to thank Chair Noor for bringing attention to targeted case management, known as TCM, where we provide person-centered support to individuals across medical, social, educational, financial, vocational, and other services. When we talk about TCM broadly, we're referring to mental health, children, vulnerable adults, individuals with disabilities, and nearly every population served by human service programs. first like to offer the context that we are in, I think, our ninth working year on redesign of targeted case management rate setting and the reimbursement methodology. And we're working hard with DHS trying to fix our TCM policies. And it's critical to ensure that we're able to continue federal Medicaid reimbursements for this work, and appreciate the chair's attention to this work as we go forward. It relies on SSIS and other technology systems as the backbone of our ability to draw down these services. This particular bill would say that if counties currently uses contracted case management services, there must be a competitive bid process. Counties have a couple of concerns about the bill as amended, and a couple of unanswered questions. First, we know there will be a county cost from a staffing and process perspective on conducting this process every 2 years. Unfortunately, this bill doesn't currently contemplate that cost for counties. In addition, expansion of this bill includes child protection, targeted case management, and other non-voluntary services, which we think are different in dynamics. For example, we have counties that contract with other counties to provide this work, and this may require them to externally contract for that. There are additional legal obligations and liabilities that come with some of those non-voluntary services. Counties agree there's a need to ensure accountability for designing culturally responsive target case management services. Are not confident that necessarily this language gets us there. Instead, counties would like to see a focus on additional state support for bringing new providers on board and helping them with licensure, which often takes a lot of work. And all across Minnesota, we know that we don't have the providers needed to reflect all of the needs of our community, especially in greater Minnesota. So we are committed to working with Chair Noor on this language to mitigate increased costs, ensure policy goals are met to adequately have culturally specific TCM services, and provide state level accountability and work on our culturally appropriate providers. Thank you very much, and happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Freeman, and I apologize if we didn't get you on the list. Okay. All right, fantastic. Is there anyone else from the audience who wishes to testify? All right, hearing none, we will move to discussion on the bill. And it looks like we have Representative Baker up first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Noor, and I don't know if this is maybe a county question or not. You know, roughly, what is the percentage now of counties that are utilizing this case management third party? I guess I'd like to have that if Matt wants to come forward maybe to that. And again, I think at the end, this is making it harder. It's another step our counties have to take to do, I think, what they're already doing. But maybe I'll just back up a little bit. And is this half our counties, Mr. Freeman?
I think it, Mr. Chair, or Ms. Chair and Representative Baker, we have varying degrees of contracting for case management, very much depending on the particular type of case management. So, again, whether it's mental health, whether it's targeted case management for child welfare in different areas, I think when we did our contracted targeted case management analysis 2 years ago, there were 55 counties that had some level of contracted targeted case management. That varies significantly based on the county size and which service, but I think broadly there are 55 counties, I believe, that would intersect with that, but DHS may have more updated numbers too.
And that's close enough, Madam Chair. That's close enough. I guess I'm just, it's more than half, and it's a good number of them. And maybe to the author of the bill, what's kind of driving this extra transparency? Has there been examples of something that's really fallen through the cracks? Maybe just help us understand why we are having our counties do more with really not reimbursing them, but what are we missing? What's driving this?
Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Beck, I think that's the key question. If it's a contract, that means they're negotiated with two parties, the county and the entity that is doing the work. And for the counties, I think more about how are those contracts awarded. Who is really making sure that the process is clear? Right now, there's no clear process. You can give any person, we can talk about with the counties who's doing the work. And some of the counties have not implemented more culture appropriate services for folks who are being served. So this creates a process whereby it's clear that if you're going to use outside contract, you have to do an RFP. But if we're going to say you don't have to do an RFP, we actually shifting the work that the county is supposed to do to an outside entity with no accountability. So if we want to hold people accountable in the process, then we do have to have the guardrails in the process that we're talking about right now. If we're willing to do that work, I think this is a clear process for the counties to follow. And if we don't give them guidance, then we're failing our duties as a state legislator.
Madam Chair.
Representative Baker.
Thank you. I understand your goal is to make sure that we've got as much inclusion as we can to make sure all parties are kind of brought to the table. You are recognizing that this is more work for the counties to do. And why did you pick the 2-year, maybe not a 5-year, or some kind of a longer process to start a little slower than this? This is 2 years, as we all know, as representative, 2 years, this is, comes around pretty quick. Why 2 years and your thoughts?
Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, members, I'm open to that conversation. I've not heard from a single county about why they will, how they want to operate this process. None of the counties have reached out to me completely. This bill has been out there. We went through the policy. Now it's in the finance. I've not heard from a single county of any concerns with the 2 years. If their concerns with the 2 years are more open, in fact, some of the counties may have continuous contractual arguments saying they will review it and then to be able to approve it, because it's up to the county commissioners to be able to continue that work as based on some of the work that they do. They can provide additional saying that we will give you the 2 years, but then they can extend, continuous process if the contract is functioning as they designed to function.
Just a final comment, Madam Chair. I think anything that we do to make our county partners and the folks that are actually paid and asked to deliver the services, making it harder, we should really caution and question. I think that we all know the workforce issues. I had a really good meeting with my county here a few days ago about the challenges that they're having with their mental health consortium, the grants and the contracts that they have to go through, and just the burden of administrative work is becoming too much for a lot of our counties. We're state administered, county delivered is our mantra here in the state of Minnesota. We just need to make sure that counties who are most trusted, who have more eyeballs on making sure they're saving a buck anywhere, is really, I think, at the county level in most cases. So I just caution any more mandates and rules that the counties have to do isn't what they're asking for. They may not oppose it, but I'm sure hearing it from it. So I just want to make sure the members are aware of that. So please be supportive of our counties and their administrators that have to do this. So this is a big deal. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Baker. And next on the list, Mr. Chair, would you like to make comment on that?
Quick comment. Thank you so much, Representative Baker. I think the question is, are the counties doing the contract right now? Absolutely, because the counties are required as part of their process, because you can't just give someone a contract without having that RFP process. You can't be choosing anyone. So they're already doing this process. The question is for how long, and how are they, making sure that they follow specific guidance from legislative process. So that's exactly what we're doing here. We're not creating a new process, but it also addresses the need for workforce. When you don't have enough case management, when you don't have people who are able to do this work, this gives them the opportunity to increase that workforce and case management in other aspects.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, we're going to go to Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Noor. I'm trying to wrap my head around, you said that the problem we're trying to solve here is to add some guardrails. Can you just talk to us a little bit about what specific, this is not lengthy language, right? There's not much to this. So can you talk to us a little bit about specifically what guardrails are we adding?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lead New Brindley. I think it's to be more specific. Case management done by an outside entity. It's required of the counties to do, and many counties do case management within the county process. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that they are not able to do this work, they want expertise and they want other people to have the burden of doing that case management. What I have seen on the ground is we fail sometimes when you've got case managers who are not familiar with the work of the department, DHS, and the county and everything else, you end up getting case management that is not completely fully in compliance with what we do. So this gives them the opportunity to say, you didn't do your work, they can be able to find another person. At this point, I think what some of the counties, it takes more than 2 years. It takes more than even 5 years for them just to open up a contract to address the need in case management. The question that we should be asking, why are the counties using external entities to do the work that we're asking the counties to do? We want them to have a success. We want them to have a workforce that can do this work. If we're giving them that flexibility, then we're telling them, every 2 years, make sure you do have a contract to address the needs that you've told us that you have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lead New Brindley, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Noor. I'm still trying to understand the guardrails, because the only guardrails I read in here, I read two guardrails. One, they have to do it every 2 years instead of right now. I suppose it's up to the county as they have need, right? So I suppose there is a guardrail in that you are forcing them to review their third-party contractors more often. I'm assuming that would be guardrail number one. Guardrail number two would be that now they must ensure that the county maintains a culturally specific program for case management. That would be guardrail number two. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chair.
That's under section 256B076, which is more specific in terms of the work that they're doing already.
Lee New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my question then is I have to assume that the second guardrail here, the ensuring the maintaining culturally specific program for case management, my guess is that could be a more difficult portion to fill. And frankly, a lot of our counties around the state don't have significant needs, frankly, for maintaining culturally specific programs. I mean, you know, for better or worse, some of our counties have very, very low populations, very, very low populations that would require a culturally specific program. So my question related to this is, what is the lay of the land for the availability of these third-party contractors? What does that workforce look like? How many of these third-party agencies are even available to do this work that would meet that second criteria?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Lead New Brindley. I think if you read in details, that is based on the need of the counties. And I can tell you right now, most of the smaller counties do the case management themselves because they can achieve the goals that are set in case management. So this will not even impact those smaller counties. But for larger counties, which actually utilizes a variety of groups and entities to do this work, what we have seen is they often not include more culture specific needs of the population that they're serving. And if we put this is making sure that for those who have got specific needs, we can actually achieve the goals. We have got tribal government, government-to-government relations that need to make sure that we are able to serve those needs. We also have individuals, BIPOC communities, that need specific culture-appropriate case management. If that cannot be achieved by the bigger counties that we serve right now, then we're not doing our task in making sure that case management is more specific to the needs of the individuals that they serve.
Madam Chair. Lee New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Noor. And I guess maybe I would ask that question of Mr. Freeman, if you happen to know what the lay of the land is on that and what the availability is for counties, because I heard once again a need reiterated, but I did not hear what is available, which was actually my question. I want to know what's available. Are there third-party contractors? Is there one third-party contractor who offers these services that we are now giving these contracts to? Or are there 20 third-party contractors who can manage these services, and there is a legitimate RFP? Otherwise, all we're doing is forcing every county who contracts within the next 2 years to give all their business and contract with one organization. So I'm wondering if you have an idea of what the lay of the land is and how many contractors you might have to choose from.
Thank you. Mr. Freeman.
Madam Chair and Committee, I don't have specifics on how many of those contractors. I can touch base with our members. I do know that, particularly in Greater Minnesota, you'd be looking at regional options for the most part, not just within your own individual county based on capacity. Many of our counties that do contracted targeted case management do it for the sole reason that Chair Noor has pointed out, to find case managers that are culturally aware and have relationships in the community and can better meet specific communities' needs. So that's part of the goal of that, and I believe that particularly in the metro, there are a variety of contracted case management options. I can't speak to the specifics of it, but I can check in with members and get back to you.
Madam Chair.
Lead New Brindley, just to keep in mind, we are only on the first bill. We have two more members on the list, and we have three more bills to get to.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I would just say this is a significant unfunded mandate on our counties. Our counties already do this process, but right now this is going to force them into a rapid cycle for this process. I mean, any RFP, we all know how this works, right? Any RFP process, it's going to take 6 months to get this done and let a contract, and now we're going to force them to do that every 2 years. That is a rapid cycle for our counties, and they will incur significant costs. I would also say we do need to have an understanding of what contractors are available, because if we don't, that's also going to drive up costs. If there are very few contractors who are able to fulfill the requirements of this legislation, that, I mean, it's simple supply and demand, right? The costs are going to go up if there are few contractors who can provide the services. So I hope that we spend some time and make sure we understand the lay of the land before we move forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and move on to Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. Chair Noor, you mentioned oversight and the counties needing to do the pieces that we require in law, right? There's certain expectations of contracted case managers, just like there are certain expectations of county case managers. When the county contracts with an agency, what happens if they don't do the required things? They aren't turning in support plans in a timely manner. They aren't doing their monthly in-person visits under targeted children's mental health. They aren't doing DAs under targeted children's mental health. The documentation isn't in alignment. How does that work now? What happens if that's not happening?
Mr. Freeman.
Or Chair Noor. I don't know who the question is to. Chair Noor had brought it up, so I thought I'd ask the follow-up.
Madam Chair, I would say that our counties manage those contracts to fulfill the requirements in the contract and carry out an act on behalf of counties.
Right. Chair Noor, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Madam Chair, Representative Hicks, that's a good question. If the contracted case managers are unable to deliver, that means someone who is in need will not get the services that they deserve. Whether you're a disabled person, whether you're an elderly person, whether you're a BIPOC individual, that means the services that you're seeking from the county and the state will not be delivered to that individual.
Can I follow up? Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you, because I appreciate our county partners, and I think it's really important that we be partners with them. But my prime responsibility is to our constituents and the people needing to access services. And so, follow-up question, who provides all the training for the consultant, the contracted county case managers? Do they get their training in the same way that our county employees do? Do they have a direct line to DHS? Do our contracted case managers go through the county? Like, how does this work?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Freeman.
I'm probably out of my depth on the details of how we're training our contracted case managers. I do know that the requirements to carry out the duties do include some of those trainings and some of those training requirements that DHS provides, but I would maybe defer to DHS to speak to how they're interacting with contracted versus county case managers.
Thank you. I know we're in a rush, so we can talk offline, but I think, you know, it's important that we don't overshadow the needs of people accessing services because of that it's hard. There's a lot of things that are hard. But at the end of the day, making sure that people who need access to targeted case management is priority one, even if sometimes how we get there is hard. So thank you, Chair Noor.
Thank you, Representative Hitz. Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Noor, my question is, there's 87 counties, and I'm concerned on how we're going to have effectiveness when we remove and don't have that local control. We have county boards, we have county administrators, we have the goal to have localized government. 87 counties have different needs. You said the small counties do the work themselves, so if this is an issue in the large county, I'm wondering why the county doesn't make an initiative at a county level specific to that county. We're implementing something, it sounds like to me, a one shoe fits all feet when it's not an issue. We're creating an issue that doesn't exist in 87 counties after I've listened to this. So I'm wondering your thought process on that, because if this is isolated to a few large counties, I'm wondering what your thought process on why that can't be handled at a local county level. Why we're increasing our responsibilities as an umbrella as elected officials at the state. Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Snicker, I think this is not creating more work for those counties that are not doing contracted case management. If a county right now is doing their service, this section of the law will not have an impact on them. But if they're going to be using, under contract case management, then this will apply. And the good question that you asked, why can't the counties do this work themselves? That's a question for the counties to answer. Why can they not have county employees who are well-qualified, well-trained, to be able to do this type of work? Nobody has said no to that. If you ask me, I'd rather have a county employee do some of this work that is necessary, because they do have access to the system, they do have access to the department. Right now, if you're a contracted case manager, you may not have access to all the resources that are required for you to do case management. So we're trying to make sure that, yes, if there are counties that are doing right now the services, nothing will change.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any follow-up, Representative Zalesnikar?
Yes, Chair. My follow-up question would just be that I guess I would say that we have a workforce shortage, sit on that committee too. So it appears to me that the counties are likely in a contract position because they have to be creative. And so taking tools out of the toolbox is not a good idea, in my opinion. We need to allow people to have as many tools in the toolbox to allow the services to be provided to the constituents that live in all these counties. And so with telehealth and a lot of different opportunities, I can see that sometimes the contracted services may be what they need to have, because otherwise there could be open positions in a county till the end of time. And we're talking about mental health services. So I think having the flexibility and letting the counties determine that at a local level is really important. I think we're in a situation of overreach, and we have an abundance of issues right now, but having things happen at a local level, Lake County knows Lake County the best, St. Louis County knows St. Louis County the best, Hennepin County knows Hennepin County the best, Stearns County, it goes on and on. I think we need to really rethink this, and 2 years is going to be a tremendous burden. Every 2 years to do this process, I've been involved with RFPs with the counties. It's a labor-intensive process when we're trying to have more time with clients, more time with the people that we're serving in need. So I hope you would be open to rethinking that piece, because it will be cumbersome at a time when they don't have SSIS, they don't have a systemized way to do things as it is. So we're adding more work for them, and we're taking away nothing. And we're not even giving them the tools to do their job at the county level. And so if we want to be more efficient, we've got to get some of the basics done first before we keep adding on more mandates to the people that are doing the work. Thank you.
All right. Chair Noor, we do not have anyone else on the list. So why don't I give it to you for final comments?
and then we'll go ahead and take action.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think I'm committed to working with the counties and figure out what is the best for them to do. And in fact, we're also going to be doing the targeted case management redesign as we're having conversation as part of this process. With that, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 4360 as amended to be laid over, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. We will go ahead then. Thank you. We will lay over House File 4360 as amended. All right. Let's move on to the next. Chair Noor, we have House File 5329. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is something that I think is important to all of us. We have talked about the issues that we're facing with substance use disorder and so many lives being lost. In fact, in Hennepin County, it's always one person per day. If you look at the count of number of people that we use losing to opioids, and Chair Baker's, you know, Representative Baker's always reminded us of why we need to be more cognizant of this. So this creates a pilot program that will address the needs of youth. As we have seen, children as young as 10 years old, or even younger than that, especially in middle school and high school, who have lost their lives. We have seen how this has devastated the youth. We've always talked about the adults. So this is a pilot program so that we can work with the county and their partners to do a pilot project that will provide peer recovery support services to the youth and from age between age 13 to 18 years of age. That's what we have before us, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do not have any amendments on this bill, and I believe the intent is to lay this bill over. With that, we'll move to discussion. Representative Baker.
Thank you, and thanks for the bill. You, especially in Hennepin County, have a huge issue with this. I've worked with a number of agencies down there, too. My question might be, I know we don't have a fiscal note on this right now. I know it's coming. Like so many others, they're so behind on this, but I know this is important. My question to you, Chair Noor, is, you know, Hennepin County, I think, last time I checked, is receiving about $42 million from the settlement funds from pharmaceutical companies and distributors. This pilot project is a good idea. I just wonder, has that conversation happened that they could use those monies towards this? Just because of our completely unrealistic constraints that we have with budgeting here in this committee this year, has that been approached and looked into with our good people in Hennepin County actually working on this issue that I've worked with? Is that an area we can work on with Hennepin County with the settlement dollars?
Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Beck, I think, yes, we have good different avenues, including the OREC funds that we have to make sure that we can support this type of work. So this is more aligned with the work that you've been doing, and we wanted to make sure that we bring this forward and so that we have that legislative requirement for them to send us the report back so we can react to what has happened in terms of providing peer support. And likewise, I think when we're talking about recovery community organizations, they will be able to see this in a different perspective. So we want to make sure that that is captured under the state statute.
And Madam Chair, just final comment. And again, for the new members and folks that weren't involved in the whole settlement dollars coming in, I know we talked about it just briefly last week. $500 million is coming into Minnesota over the next 16 years. It's not all here at one time. It's not like it's a ton of money when you look at the long-range plan. But cities of over 20,000 population, along with every single county, received 75% of the funds coming to Minnesota. I just want to make sure that we know that there's been a lot of money that we've all worked hard to get here. Doesn't always have to come through our pot of money here. There's a lot of money sitting there with our larger cities, Brooklyn Center, the other ones that are doing this. So I'm not saying we don't have a place here. I'm just saying when our budgets are super tight, we've got money out there too. So I hope that we are looking at our communities to see where they can help us as well. So that was my only comment. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Carly Katiza-Watoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Noor, for bringing this proposal forward. I think, as a fellow Hennepin County representative and also a representative of a community who has a large Eastern African population, I think that this is a conversation worth having, and I think that you know, as our population continues to shift and diversify over the coming years, I mean, particularly, you know, with incoming immigrants and workers who are going to settle all across the state of Minnesota, putting a pilot forward like this, where we have such a large population already, and then figuring out how we can bring that culturally responsive support statewide to people in the East African community, I think is really worthwhile. So I appreciate your leadership on this, and look forward to partnership in the future.
Thank you, Representative Katiza Watun. And finally, Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Noor. My question is, we've obviously been having a lot of conversations about peer recovery supports more broadly, because we've seen that actually needs to be tightened up. This does not offer any of that kind of language. What's your intention with that,
Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think we don't have any peer recovery right now that is more designed for the teenagers that I talked about from age 13 to 18. So this will give us an opportunity to understand their needs and how we can be able to provide peer recovery. In fact, I do have a testifier who wanted to testify on this and how this has impacted him. So I think hearing from him will be beneficial.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is that testifier here today? We did not have anyone on the list. Ah, very good. Well, then, at this time, and my apologies, Representative New Brindley, we'll come back to you if you have any follow-up, and then we'll follow with the testifier. Apologies, we did not have you on the list. Please go ahead, come and sit and give your name and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and the entire Human Services Finance Committee. Thank you all for your continuous efforts for our communities. My name is Abdurrahman Warsama. I'm a second generation immigrant Somali American who's in long-term recovery. I will be 5 years sober on June 16th of this year, and I've also been a peer recovery specialist since 2020. And I'm an advocate for recovery. I started using substances as a young adult in high school, and my drug use only increased as I grew older. As time went on, I only lost more friends and family to the opioid epidemic that has spread across this country. Data shows that 90% of Americans who meet the clinical criteria for addiction started using substances before the age of 18. Recent data from the Monitoring of the Future survey shows that the percentage of adolescents reporting that they have used any illicit substances in 2023 continued to hold steady below the pre-pandemic levels reported in 2020, with a 10.9% of 8th graders, 19.8% of 10th graders, and a 31.2% of 12th graders reporting any illicit drug use in the past year. That was taken from an article with the National Institute of Health. I've come across many youth in my life that have struggled with addiction, and recovery services available to them is extremely minimal. Most times, treatment services are what most adolescent clients use, often lasting 3 to 6 months at best. But recovery is a lifetime commitment. You take it day by day. Peer recovery support services is a proven method to help individuals stay sober in a time when support is needed most. Data shows that 95% of people relapse within their first year of recovery. Did you know that someone is 300 times more likely to overdose if they use illicit substances, especially fentanyl, after completing treatment? And with that question in mind, I urge you to consider supporting Representative Noor on this important bill to support our youth. Thank you.
Thank you for being here, and thank you for sharing your story. I think it takes a lot of courage to come before the legislature and share something so personal. So I really appreciate it. Thank you for being here. And with that, since it seems that our list is failing us a bit today, I'll just make one more request. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify that was not on our list? All right. Okay. Hearing none, we will go back to discussion. Representative Brindley, did you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize. I missed your name to the testifier, but congratulations on 5 years.
Thank you.
I feel like you're young enough that 5 years, you're going to do really well.
Thank you. Sincerely,
frankly, in the last 2 years, I've lost both of my brothers.
I'm so sorry.
And I'm so proud of you and excited for your future.
Thank you.
That said, I would continue to ask the question. I know that we can always find ways to spend money legislatively. That's just not always the right answer. And in this particular situation, we do have significant resources available for exactly this kind of project outside of the legislature. And right now, everything we spend legislatively only adds to our problem down the line, a problem we already know exists. And especially when we have numbers like $42 million to work with, it just does not make sense to spend money out of the legislature, general fund. It just does not make sense. So I hope that we continue to find solutions. I hope that you will work with folks like Representative Baker, who live and breathe this and understand these issues better than anybody, because I suspect that he could give you some really good thoughts on this. And how, where this money can come from. But that's, I mean, we've worked really hard to ensure that there is funding in this area. Let's use it. Let's use that money. We got to stop going back to the well. We just don't have the money in the general fund. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Lee New Brindley. I just want to remind folks that we are laying this over for possible inclusion, which means there is certainly more discussion that will be had, particularly on funding and all of those fun things. But I think it's good to hear that we certainly all agree that this is an important endeavor. So with that, Chair Noor, would you have any final comments on the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I look forward to working with Representative Baker and figuring out how we proceed with this issue. And thank you so much for hearing the bill. I renew my motion that House File 5329 to be laid over.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that, House File 5329 will be laid over for possible inclusion. And we will return the gavel to the chair.
The next bill that we have on the agenda is House File 5200. I will move that on behalf of Representative Gillard, House File 5200 to be laid over. And I see you've got A4 amendment. Did you want to proceed with the A4 amendment, Representative Gillard?
Thank you, Chair and members. Would it, the DE amendment adds kind of a significant component to it. Is there a way that we could talk about the bill maybe as it is first before we amend it?
Yes, please proceed.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair and members. I'm not totally sure what day of the week it is, right, but happy whatever day it is and glad that we're all here. This bill really comes to the work that we've been doing around preventing and ending homelessness in Minnesota. In 2021, we actually had a Preventing Homelessness Committee where we had a lot of discussions about what do we need to do in the state to really end homelessness, and there's so many components to that. That's one thing that we learned, I think, and bipartisanly really agreed on. And what we did in the last 2 years is make a significant investment in our shelter, emergency shelter capacity, getting people off of the streets. But there's a long-term continuum that happens here. I like to think of it as this braided approach, that we braid all of these things together for a long-term strength to actually do the work that we're trying to do. And so what this bill does is it's creating a working group, taking a geographic spread, because I do think that that's important, that, you know, we try to have geographic voices at the table when we do working groups on ways to simplify supportive housing. And the nice thing about supportive housing is it's a long-term solution and evidence-based, proven to have good outcomes. What it does is it weaves together rental assistance, but also the supportive tools that individuals need for the long-term support to actually get out of homelessness, dig out of poverty, and become successful individuals in Minnesota. And so with that, Chair, I guess if we could move to testifiers to talk about this portion of the bill, I think that may be best.
Thank you so much. I think we have testifiers who have signed up. The first person is Sean, Pierre Sean. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and the chair committees. My name is Pia Shong. I am the executive director of Handy Help. We have over 100 employees and over 1,000 clients. Our 50-60% of our clients are culturally from the culturally specific, and we have about over 60% of my staff are culturally specific, meaning that English is not their first language. Over the last 10 years, we've been providing support in various ways to help people maintain independent housing in the community. And currently, one of the challenges that we have has been why this is so important is that when you have employees who don't speak English, or English is not the language, and you have clients who don't speak English, or that's not their primary language, I think that English in itself is pretty complicated, along with the acronyms and all of that stuff. To add in all the complexity, we have all these forms, and then we have multiple steps that we have to have someone who's homeless in an encampment. We're trying to get them transportation, getting them into the coordinated entry, just to get this assessment that's very lengthy. After all these lengthy assessments, the person thought they're ready for housing or for the support, but they're not. Because from there, they take the assessment. The person then has to go on to work with a designated case manager who has to verify every step if they're homeless and every information. And this takes it takes weeks to a month before they can even get services. Multiple forms, and we also asked, the forms are very complex, and a lot of forms may be asking the same questions, but different forms is required. And we put the clients through all this traumatic experience, especially if they have mental health. A lot of time when they're in encampments or homeless, their mental health may not be well taken care of. Their days, they don't know their days. Diet, nutrition, they haven't had their health or physical for a while. So with this, we have clients who are trying to tell their traumatic experience all the time, every time, and every questions they have to talk about it, and they thought they're done, they have to ask more. Same questions, but different forms. With all of this, I believe that as a provider, the simplicity and simplifying all these forms would be extremely helpful, not just to not have a client have to go through this traumatic experience and having to talk about their experience all the time, but it goes to one place to another with transportation being difficult so that we can get services on board. As a provider, I think it's really difficult to get clients to get services because we lose them after one appointment or two because having to go all of this, we can't even get them into getting services. They're lost already with the assessment. Or trying to get to assessment is extremely difficult. And I think that the simplicity of the forms and reducing duplication would be extremely helpful to get clients to benefit from the services. We talk about equity. And I think that because all clients come from a different place, we have to look at different ways to get client enrolled. In addition to that, on a worker standpoint, as a cultural specific provider, getting my worker to learn to do English, they know the work, but getting them to do all these forms over and over, it takes such a long time for them to do this form with the clients, and then nothing comes out of it because the clients have already lost trust with the government, with the providers, and they still don't get services. By the time they get a phone call from the provider or whoever, they have already lost they went through three phone numbers already, and this is so hard. And the training behind the scene to get a culturally specific worker to get out there, that's a lot of work. As a clinical supervisor, as a supervisor behind the scene who's trying to proofread, I'm not an English major, but in this job, I learned to be because if they don't do this form like the housing focus plan correctly, they may get rejected. 30 days with the forms in DHS, coming back and say it's not good enough. I think that there's a lot of forms that have not been updated with DHS, and I know we mean well. We want to work together so that the form reflects the real time, because right now, getting a PSN, it's extremely difficult. Doctors are exhausted. Professionals they don't have capacity. So when our workers trying to send this PSN for someone to sign, it takes forever, and it sits forever, and they don't get that. On top of just getting certification like a PSN or medical opinion, there are three different ways to verify disabilities. you may get a mental health professional to sign off, but then they can't get a medical doctor to sign on the medical opinion form. And all of this, again, it's a way to discriminate people who do not have to get on system. And I think that's why we have so many clients who are in encampment, because getting services is extremely hard. So with that, I truly support something that simplifies things, and I know that we can do this, and I think that as a system, I think we can find a solution to help those who maybe already don't trust the system, don't trust the government, that we can make this system so much easier so that we can really truly talk about equity and that we can walk equity and not just talk about it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person is Lindsay Hoffa. If you can come to the testify table, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Knorr, Vice Chair Bonner, and committee members, my name is Lindsay Hofer. I am the program director at the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, MACV. We are a statewide 501c3 nonprofit with a mission to end veteran homelessness in Minnesota. We pursue our mission in partnership with local, state, and federal veteran-focused organizations who support our work in housing, housing subsidies, program development, holistic case management, and thought leadership, which has formed many of these critical interventions. I will be part of the work group this bill aims to establish. While MACV and our partners have made incredible progress towards our goal of ending veteran homelessness, we've also seen how the administrative complexities of the social service system can delay or prevent our veterans from accessing housing. To mitigate this gap, MACV launched a documentation specialist program in August of 2023. This program offers transportation, coordination, and technical assistance to veterans needing vital documents for services, employment, and housing. While this program has already proved successful in reducing the time a veteran is experiencing homelessness, our one FTE is not enough to solve this broad issue that affects all Minnesota veterans experiencing homelessness. We believe establishing this work group will be a great step forward in easing the bureaucratic burdens of our unhoused neighbors, including the 248 veterans experiencing homelessness in our state today. Thank you for your support of this initiative, and Representative Keeler, thank you for offering this bill.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Do we have anyone in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, back to you, Representative Keeler. Did you want to move the amendment now?
Thanks, Chair. Could we have member discussion? I feel like the amendment is doing a lot of things that I don't want to take away from having the conversation about creating the workforce and the importance of that. If there's any member discussion, I think I want to be able to say that this is absolutely a work in progress. I'm a bill author that's still looking at amendments and what the agency sent over and still trying to work to make this right. So it is a work in progress, but absolutely, if we could have that conversation, I think that would be great in this moment.
Lead New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, Representative Keeler, I want to thank you for reaching out to me outside of committee. As I said, she approached me and said, I want to talk to you about making you hate this less. And I said, I actually don't hate it. So It was a good start. And in fact, to the first testifier, I would say I really appreciate the things he had to say. And, one of the things we talked about, I think, extensively in that committee is how complicated it is. These lengthy assessments, it's time-consuming case management. And I thought, boy, wouldn't it be interesting if we as legislators could figure out how to help government function in a way that it actually serves people and we don't have to pay probably billions of dollars in case management if we actually simplified government so that it actually just worked for people. That would be remarkable. And I think that's your goal. I think that's your goal, is to simplify this process so that it actually works for people. And so just right off the bat, I want to say I actually really appreciate that goal for this bill. And like I said, the amount of money we spend in case management, just helping people navigate a complicated system, is sort of obscene. And so if we can simplify that and try to start minimizing those costs so that those dollars can actually go towards helping people in more tangible ways, I think that's a benefit to, I think that's the benefit to certainly the folks who need the help. It's a benefit to the state, and it's a benefit to taxpayers. I think that is win-win-win. So I really appreciate that. And I also appreciate the fact that this is a work in progress. I think it is interesting that in the amendment, which we will discuss, that one of the nonprofits is switched out for the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, which actually I think it's important to have MACV involved in the conversation, because of course veterans are a unique group in that there are a lot of other resources available to veterans that have really helped to largely solve the homelessness problem among mm-hmm. veterans. So it makes sense to have that voice at the table. I think that is also really important. So that's whether the switch is good or not, I'm not going to comment on that. But to have veterans groups who understand this issue at the table, I think is really important. You know, some things that we talked about that I do think are important to think through is, does it make sense in this language to specifically delineate exactly which nonprofit organizations are going to have a seat at the table? I'm not sure that that's the best way to do this. I also think that sometimes in an effort to make things appear nonpartisan, we explicitly make them partisan. And I appreciate your concession on this point as well. You know, this bill language would include a member appointed by the Speaker of the House and a member appointed by the Senate Majority Leader, which means that it's entirely possible, not necessarily true, but entirely possible, that it would exclusively include one party. And I think that we get better results, and I know that you believe this, when we have different voices at the table and different ways of viewing things, and we're asking different questions. So I think things like that are important as well. Obviously, this is the kind of thing that, you know, once again, we spent $500 million on homelessness last year, in addition to all of the money that was already in homelessness. And this is the kind of thing that I wish we had included in that, because now anything we're spending is adding to our deficit problem. So, I mean, we should look at these numbers and see if they make sense. But we are adding to that problem. We need a broader coalition. The other piece I would ask you to consider is, you know, I've authored legislation for the last, I think, 4 years now, modeled after our workforce legislation, so that we can start to get a handle on, this is such a complex area. And, you know, I mean, we were just kind of offline saying, well, how much money did we spend last year? Well, it's complicated because it's all very interconnected, right, in lots of different areas. And so we need to start getting a handle on where the money is going, what populations are being served, you know, what aspect of homelessness are they addressing, and what are their success rates? Because we need to start to get a handle on, you know, if there are two organizations who are serving essentially the same population, offering the same services, but one has a really good success rate and one is meh, mm-hmm. Well, then we need to amplify organizations that are successful. So we need to start gathering that data and understanding what is happening in this space now, because the one thing I think we all agreed on in that committee was that, boy, we don't have a handle on this, and we don't know exactly how much money is in homelessness, where it's going, what populations are being served. And so I hope that we will consider some reporting requirements. And like I said, I have legislation modeled after our workforce. We require this of nonprofits who receive workforce funding. We require them to report who they're serving, you know, what are their outcomes 2 years, 4 years, whatever those specific numbers are. But we require that so that we can know what programs should we be amplifying and what should we maybe consider cutting loose, because they're not the best use of taxpayer dollars. So I apologize for going on. I actually appreciate the intent of this and just hope that we can consider these other things as this is a work in progress.
Any other member discussion?
Oh, wait, can I reply to that? She just gave me a whole lot, and I wasn't going to say anything. I got notes to say back.
Your notes are well taken.
thank you, Chair and Representative. I do.
Representative Kyo.
I do want to highlight the fact that we do really need to look at the forms, you know, like really having a review on that and what state and federal level and how we can reduce that, because I think we all agree getting into the work is actually so much more important than the paperwork part of it. Being efficient and effective is my goal. Coming out of poverty, I feel like I always try to get my pennies to stretch as far as possible with good intention, and that's really what the goal of this work is. I do, if you could see all my colored notes on the things, some of the things that you brought up, you know, when we heard in Children and Family, I think it was earlier this week, another committee was, language was written like that, that it's one member from the House, one member from the Senate, and I even brought it up then, and I think Zalesnikar was there, that does not sit ethically well with me, because I do think it brings value to the table when our different philosophies of solution can come together and really work at a long-term goal. So taking that into consideration, and also the named piece of it, I think we have maybe some approaches we can look at from there. Also understanding that we all have players that we really believe are doing a great job in this area, and bringing them together actually gives us the best outcome for the future of Minnesota. So those are points are all very well taken. And I think you've given me some other points that I'll utilize to lead into the other part of my amendment. Chair, if there's any other members that want to talk about the first part of the bill.
I see no any other member on the list. So with that, I think we should proceed to the A4 amendment.
Okay.
I move A4 amendment on behalf of Representative Keller. So please, if you can give us a brief statement on that, and we will go to member discussion.
Thank you, Chair and members. So the amendment here, part of what the amendment does is it does take into consideration some of the things we heard from stakeholders and the testifiers today by adding language to include coordinated entry as one of the things this workforce would, or this working group would actually look into. From what it said, maybe even the forms would be another thing to add. But the piece around this that probably has more to discuss is the fact that we're actually adding, we're adding a new department into DHS, and what this does, and Chair Noor, if you want to help me kind of walk through this, but it's creating a lane for a lot of the agency or a lot of the work that is slated to move over to DCYF, which is the Department of Children, Youth, and Family. A lot of the homelessness work is moving over to that department as it's slated today. There's a group of us who have deeply worked on preventing homelessness, stemming back from the Preventing Homelessness Committee, that really feel strongly that a lot of the homelessness work, back to some of the things, veterans, families with adults, and families that, or individuals that don't have dependents, that if we move our homelessness efforts to DCYF, there's a concern that those efforts would only be focused on children, youth, and family, and not the entire person or individuals of Minnesota. We also know that the groups and the programs that are staying within DHS align with our homelessness efforts as well. And so it's a fix that we use this bill as the vehicle to add, to have that conversation in an honest, good way, to try to make sure that all of the money we did put into play around homelessness doesn't drop through cracks of moving into a brand new agency. And it's a way that we can continue to stay focused. I do like the idea of some sort of intentional reporting back, and I think adding some sort of department that would oversee homelessness and housing supports only, we could do more reporting, including the where, the who, the why, the uniqueness, and what does success look like, and how do we meet that level of success, and what are our success goals, SWOT analysis, even if that. So I take that feedback really well and would be willing to have more conversations around that. But with that, Mr. Chair, that is the amendment. As it is.
Thank you. A member discussion. I see Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Representative Keeler, for the amount of work you've been doing and leading on these efforts. Very much appreciate the way you engage people across the process. I'm very strongly supportive of what we're looking at here from a variety of areas. You know, I've worked in the homeless youth world since 2007, and so I've seen a lot of things that have come and gone. You know, you start, your first part of the bill is great on simplifying the process out there. What really helps, I see, in this area here is, you know, bringing in the different groups that you didn't have mentioned in your first one, particularly the coordinated entry part is, mm-hmm. I know there's some good things there, but, you know, there's some things, particularly from the federal level, that just drives everybody batty, and it's good to make sure that they're part of the process. One of the things, too, is that is very important is that seeing that we're wrapping the homeless services and keeping them within this area. And the reason I say that is so often people dealing with homeless issues are dealing with many other issues at the same time that all
taken care of in the human services area. We're taking a look at addiction. We're taking a look at the mental health areas. So often we've got people who need support and assistance that are also looking at Medicaid, all these other services that are in. If we're looking at the extension of the 1115 waiver that we've talked about in this committee, once again, that's getting to people who are precariously housed. I just see us having a lot of sense wrapping these duties all together in one area. And what is really good is that we're putting this into statute. Right now, you know, the council is out there that the governor had originally established a number of years ago. And I think that as a state, if we feel it's very important, we should be putting this into statute so that doesn't rely on the whim of a governor at any one period of time, and that we put it in and give it the resources to make sure that we're focusing in and wrapping in all the other parties that need to be part of it. I think that is where we start really breaking it down. We've seen that work well with the in the veterans issue, where they brought people together and worked really well. We've made great progresses by looping in the other services when we're looking at SUD, how people discharge from their mental health. It just makes sense to further refine those connections by bringing it all together into one office. So thank you for your work. I know you'll continue working on this.
Any other member discussion? Lead New Brinley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Fisher, for your comments as well. Representative Keeler, and actually it is interesting, and I think it is good to add the coordinated entry piece. I mean, I can remember in committee hearing just a strange number of folks coming out of prisons in Clay County. Yeah. Like, just some really random, odd numbers that really do need to be part of that conversation. I think that's very interesting. I don't know why that sticks in my head from years ago. I mean, it will come as no surprise to anybody that I would have pretty significant concern, particularly at this late hour. I think I completely understand the need to figure out jurisdiction here. Especially with the new agency to figure out jurisdiction of where this will be held, and I think that's legitimate and that should be figured out. I would hope that some of that could be done more amicably behind the scenes, rather than requiring a new office and new assistant commissioner. This is a big deal, mm-hmm. to create a new office and to add an assistant commissioner and additional staff, and we all know that this is going to grow. This is a really significant thing we're doing here, and I'm a little concerned about the late hour of this coming forward. And presumably there will be a fiscal note on this, but this is going to have pretty significant costs moving forward that won't go away. And that we're going to have to figure out how to pay for in deficit years. So that would be a pretty big red flag for us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative New Brinley. So I don't know if you can remember Dr. Foldis when he did that economic statement to us when we were in Preventing Homelessness. Do you remember he had like over 1,000 youth that he follows for a year and saw that only 6% of them needed to become like fully out of homelessness to become like a functioning Minnesotan, right, to give back. And so it showed us that when we invest in homelessness, it actually has a really powerful return on investment long term. And I'll tell you, I can't sit here and say I'm a champion for homelessness and not try to do everything, even if it's at the last minute. There is genuine concern in my mind, and I think in others, and it's just a shot that I have to actually follow through with the commitment that we will do absolutely everything we can to make homelessness a priority and not allow it to just fall in all of these silos and all the spaces that we know homelessness reaches across the state. And so, again, absolutely a work in progress, not great on timing, but also more concerns have come up in the last couple weeks as we've seen the governor's package come out and show where kind of some of those that money follows. And we need to make sure that we support adults without children, seniors, veterans, all of Minnesota when it comes to it. So honestly, happy to have more conversations around it.
Any follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Keeler, for bringing this proposal forward. I know you and I have had numerous conversations about this and about some of the changes that we are going to be seeing in the shift from DHS and MDE to DCYF. I think this is a conversation worth having to ensure that there are people whose day-to-day work is solidified, and not, again, just focusing on folks who happen to have children, who happen to be young, mm-hmm. as we all are at some point in our life. But then when we reach that that point where then we are adults, and we may not have families of our own, and we may not have some of the additional dependents and then things that, so I think when we look at the interplay between those two, I think it might be worth discussing including a representative from DCYF in either in the working group potentially, just so that correspondence and knowing that in addition to focusing on all Minnesotans all across the state and meeting where they are, how that does interplay with the work that the new department will be doing. So I really appreciate your time and effort that you put into this.
Any response, yeah. Representative Kim?
Yep. Thanks, Chair. Thank you, Representative Katiza Watoon. I think that's a good point. The part that we went without naming it is that we have the interagency. And in that role, any new commissioner is already appointed to the Interagency on Homelessness. So we thought that was already including DCYF, and in the DCYF language for commissioner, they're required to join that as well. So I think in our mind, we thought that was kind of covering that area. But again, the more people we need to be engaged and crossing paths to make sure that the silo work that we do right now doesn't allow cracks for individuals to fall through.
Seeing no one else, I just wanted to note this. This has been a major discussion when we talk about homelessness and housing support. Currently, DHS is doing this work. It's not a significant shift. It's making sure that the alignment, the streamlining, and ensuring that the work that is already happening within the department continues to happen within DHS. We know that housing support will stay there. We know that the general assistant, MSA, we're talking about individual with substance use disorder. We're talking about individual with mental health. We're talking about individuals who are disabled. We're talking about seniors. We're talking about a huge population here that is currently being served under Department of Human Services. So this is a clear direction that the work is already being done, and this is how we wanted to make sure that the work continues. Whether it's the housing support or homelessness needs to stay within DHS rather than any other entity. So this is more giving the direction to the administration that it has to stay there. I don't know if you wanted to have a follow-up, Lead Newbern.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to follow up on that because, you know, I mean, there were a lot of things very clearly defined when the new department was established, and we can continue to define that. And we can define that without creating an office and significant future expenses on top of that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Your closing remarks, Representative.
Thank you, Chair and members, and honestly, thanks to everyone around the entire table and in the community for joining me in this conversation to really think broadly about, you know, what does homelessness look like in 20 years in Minnesota? I think often we make decisions as today. I'm really thinking about generations that maybe we don't even know yet. And I do just want to end on one of the most impactful memories I had in my first year here. We were in the pandemic, and we were all online in preventing homelessness, and we had a gentleman join us to tell his story, and by our next committee hearing, he had passed away. And there was a moment in time that we're just not doing enough. And I asked myself a lot, and when we set things up, how would the system right now support an individual man with no dependencies who was 70 years old in the state? And I think that's the story that resonates to me, to make sure that those are the people that we just continue to care about in this work and that we do. And we don't get it right all the time, but this is just a genuine effort to try to understand that moving forward. So thank you all for your time and your efforts to end homelessness.
Thank you so much. With that, I just wanted to ask all those in favor of A for amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
The amendment prevails. With that, I wanted to renew Representative Kill's motion that House File 5200 as amended to be laid over, so the bill is laid over. Thank you so much. The next bill we have before us is House File 4190. Representative Beck, welcome to your committee. Please introduce the bill and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. in front of you today is our final bill, House File 4190. We had a very good conversation about this in Chair Fisher's committee. Again, this is the, I will call it this year now, the aspirational bill of really trying to do some things financially for folks that are working every single day to try to help people with substance use disorder. And I'll have Mr. Zerbis come on down because I want to get right over to our expert here. But I just want to make sure that this was our early session aspirational list of what we really needed to do. There's been a, you'll hear about a rate study today. There's a lot of ideas in here to how we're going to keep helping people get their lives back. We can't do it all this year. We know that. But this is also coming back to the reality of we thought we had a bit of this fixed at the end of last year in conference committee when we had a small improvement for the reimbursements for our staffing out there that are helping people. That got stripped out last year. So this is an important part of it. I'll let Mr. Zerbis, Mr. Chair, kind of carry on the actually the parts of the bill, and then we'll wrap it up at the end. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Zerbis. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Brian Zerbis. I'm the executive director of MARCH, of the Minnesota Association of Resources for Recovery and Chemical Health. We're a statewide trade association for substance disorder programs and professionals. First, I want to give a huge thanks to Representative Baker, Representative Frederick Crayon Hollins, and Chair Fisher for being co-authors on this bill. As Representative Baker touched on, this is very important to our community and to our providers. For some context and background, in the last 2 years, there's been a net reduction of SUD programs of 45 in the state. What that means is any given year, some programs open, some close, but the net reduction means there are 45 less access points throughout Minnesota. And when you look at where those programs are closing, the seven county metro area compared to greater Minnesota, a little over 40% of all of those closures are happening in greater Minnesota, in 80 of our counties. Overdose deaths are at an all-time high. That's not new information to anyone. Workforce burnout is at a critical point. MARCH conducted a statewide survey of our members a little over a month ago. We had 627 respondents from 137 different zip codes in Minnesota, 75% of which of those staff are direct care staff, counselors, nurses, people that are working directly with our clients. What the survey indicated was a little over half of those people have considered leaving the field in the last 12 months. And for all those that answered that, about a third of them said that in the next 12 months, they're planning to leave the field. So I want to give that background and context of why this is so important. Touching on some of the pieces in House File 4190, these proposals were developed by addiction treatment professionals. 240 of our members from around the state last fall kind of came up with a lot of ideas of what would have an impact. A few of them I wanted to touch on. The waiving fees for IDs, this is a should be a small cost proposal that would replace driver's licenses, IDs, birth certificates for people that have lost them. Representative Baker touched on the 3% increase that SUD was carved out of last session. Certainly when that happens, the programs that are already back is against the wall, they're not making ends meet, not having that hope is one thing. I think the unintended consequences of raising rates for other parts of the field and the industry, the rising tides aren't raising all the boats. The SUD programs are being left behind. So all of those things compounded by closures, burnout, stress. In Section 8, the extending of the rate study, Burns and Associates rate study that was presented a couple months ago in January, we feel that they did an excellent job in identifying the true cost of what SUD rates should be, the average increase needed for those rates across all SUD lines of service is 68%. What was missed in that survey is adolescent residential and non-residential services. Those were not included in the rate. So what we'd like to do, ideally using some short-term funds to extend that rate study to figure out what is the true cost needed for adolescent, residential, non-residential, and withdrawal management. Also, room and board rates have only gone up 3% in the last 13 years. So the reimbursement rate is $55 per day. We don't know, again, that rate study ideally would be able to identify what's the true cost of eats and sheets, as it's called. The last thing, a couple things to touch on, the transition support work group. And this is looking at trying to identify, as people go to and from treatment, there's a number of issues related to housing, childcare, transportation, food assistance, all of these barriers that people have access or that impact our clients. So we'd like to have a work group be able to be comprised of state agencies and counties and providers, people in recovery, people in treatment, to try to figure out what needs to happen to make improvements in the system and come forward with those recommendations. So lastly, Mr. Chair, certainly there are many priorities that you're going to be considering as you're pulling your budgets together. We want to obviously emphasize and implore low-cost, high-impact proposals. It is something that we want to see happen, and that any immediate relief is going to have significant impacts on our field. So with that, I'll conclude, and thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I think we have another testifier, Dr. Zengna. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Dr. Lou Zeitner, and I'm the CEO of Meridian Behavioral Health, a Minnesota-based program of SUD treatments throughout the state. We have 11 residential-based treatment programs with about 650 beds from East Grand Forks to Owatonna. We employ 635 dedicated clinicians focused on the care of 7,000 patients each year. We represent more Medicaid beds than any other provider in Minnesota. While many, including our major hospital systems, have shifted their focus away from mental health and addictions care and toward better reimbursed care, we have stayed true to our mission of treating those most in need with the fewest resources. I have spent the last 43 years of my career focused on ensuring high-quality mental health and addiction care is available to all, regardless of financial resources. But we are in a time of extreme crisis. While the needs of the community continue to rise and clinical needs of our patients continue to intensify, the levels of reimbursement have remained stagnant. We have been holding our breath, waiting for the legislature to focus on payment rates for SUD residential care for a long time. We have told our banks and creditors rate increases are coming. We have told our employees the same thing. In the meantime, adjacent states have increased their reimbursement rates for Medicaid SUD care while Minnesota's rates have remained stagnant. In communities like Moorhead and East Grand Forks, North Dakota programs are pulling our best staff because they are paying 15 to 20% more than we can afford to pay. As our labor costs continue to escalate, along with insurance and other operating costs, we can no longer survive without Medicaid reimbursement increases. We appreciate the complexities of balancing the many needs that you meet with limited resources, but we may not be able to survive until it's our turn for relief. Many programs have already closed because of the financial struggles. I am here to plead with you to find a way to follow the guidance of the DHS Commission rate study that highlighted the specific financial challenges of residential care and provide relief to organizations like ours that are working to support the people of our state struggling with SUD. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Dr. Zander, for your testimony. And do we have any other person in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussions. I have Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for doing this, and also thanks for the shout out to Moorhead. And the honest struggles that we have, 20%. Right, is that being up against North Dakota, give me a service and they're doing it, right? But this one is so critical, and there is like a $4 to $5 difference an hour. Like, of course anybody's going across my river to go work in the other state. And so when we invest in things like this, I appreciate that because as a border city, it keeps our Minnesota workers in Minnesota doing work because we can't blame them for going out of state to do work when it's a $5 an hour difference. And so I just want to say thank you for your continued work on this and thank you for the consideration around this, and the shout out to Moorhead. Thanks.
Lead New Burnley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker. And I appreciate your acknowledgement in the very beginning that this is sort of an aspirational bill, right? There's a lot going on here. And yet I feel like there are pieces that don't need to be aspirational. And, you know, I mean, particularly, and I think Chair Fisher will remind me that I think we did this piece for birth certificates and driver's license things for homeless youth, which is a really kind of simple thing for us to do, but has a big impact. I mean, we're talking about folks who, you know, substance use disorder is not their only issue, right? And managing documents is the least of their concerns. So that kind of thing can be really critical, you know, and frankly, even the tax credit for employees, while it's a big number, everything we touch on in this committee is about workforce. And while this might not be affordable right now, it actually addresses workforce, which is what we really need to do. I do have an actual question, and my question is, you know, like I said, I mean, I suspect you recognize that some pieces of this are more aspirational than others, but it seems like there are pieces, and I love the data piece on treatment effectiveness. I mean, it's what we were just talking about with homelessness, right? I love this effectiveness piece. We have to be amplifying things that work. And so my question is, have you thought about, I assume we don't have a fiscal note for this yet, so have you thought about where we might be able to pull some funding from other places into this? I mean, I just think even DHS has a ton of unfilled FTEs that could absorb some of these costs, like the birth certificate piece or whatever. Have you thought about that?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Great question. I certainly have, and I'm asking our friends, you know, Mr. Berg, to help us with some of those. I'm actually writing an email today to MMB to kind of see at what level there are still some funds out there. There was a ton of money put into some areas, and I don't have my list with me. I apologize. But because of the levels of increased spending last year and this year, talking with our friends at DHS, they are overwhelmed with just getting enough people hired in all areas. There's a lot of problems with that. We gave them money, but they also just don't have the humans. And so when we're not hiring people, it does show a number of savings as well. It is very challenging to start pulling back funds from what's been allocated last year. I want to leave nothing unturned because this is really critical. As you just heard, 20% across the borders. We're Minnesota, we're not North Dakota, and my goodness, it's embarrassing to hear that, but yet Minnesota is trying to do it all in all areas, and that's our problem. We're being buried in overwhelming commitments in the future of so many areas and so many things. We can't focus on the things that really help people get stood up. So those are the reasons why we need to fight hard for this year to find the money somewhere. And I know it's not natural to come back and pull money back. I hope to have a conversation with the Chair of Ways and Means shortly to just to say what is possible. I know targets and agreed to. I know when the majority kind of gets so set up, it's really hard to change that. Chair Knorr needs more money. He needs more money, and it should have came last year. It should have come in a different way. But we need to find a way to do that. I will continue to fight, and I think we'll have those conversations as this bill moves along. I'm looking forward to next week a lot when we start marking these things up so we can start offering some ideas, not just throw problems. Let's find some areas where we really think we can actually make some changes. So I look forward to that next week.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker, for bringing this bill. I've had tremendous feedback from providers and family members on the importance of this and how things are falling through the cracks, and it's only going to continue. So from the analysis I've seen, the wages are very low, and meanwhile, we're talking about raising minimum wage, you know, in other classifications. And so this isn't, and not that those things aren't important, but this is not giving somebody a cone or giving me a coffee through the drive-through. These are like critical services. So when we keep diluting these critical direct caregiving, like in the chemical dependency and assisted livings and nursing homes and all these other care, we're not going to find caregivers to do this critical work. it just dilutes it all. And so we're chasing our tail continually. And so thank you for centering us back on what we need to do and where we need to put our resources to pay people for the shift work, weekends, holidays, the important stuff, and really focus it on the right priorities, which this is one of them, and there's several of them. The homeless issue, this issue, the addictions, nursing homes and assisted livings are under fire. We've listened to direct care and treatment issues. We've got forensic people waiting in hospitals. This list goes on and on. But essentially, we got to pay our critical caregivers, direct caregivers, and value them. And if we keep diluting their value, we are not going to have a safety net to be able to take care of the most critical people at need. So thank you for bringing this bill and keeping it in front of our minds. Thanks.
Well, thank you. I know we've talked about the well being dry, and I'm glad that Representative Baker is looking for other ways for us to get some funding. I'll appreciate that if we could get it. I'm sure we'll do a good, with what we have. So with that, I think I'll give it to back to you for closing.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, I want to do two things when I wrap this bill up, because I know that next week and others in the closing weeks here, you've got a lot of decisions to make. I can continue to bang the drum of why don't we have money. That's not here today. What's here today is this is an issue that to those people out there sitting around the support groups that are looking at us in the camera right now, I want you to understand we are all fighting to try to find dollars to give you better pay, more support systems, to try to reduce your paperwork, to try to find better processes to not have you work so many long nights and weekends, when we can try to find our policy ways, like Chair Fisher's bill is coming next week. That we've got some good things in that bill, and I want to really say this is a very bipartisan issue that we're going to work really hard on to those folks listening to us. But I really do want to thank Chair Fisher, Representative Frederick, and others. Chair Norr, you've been really great about this whole thing, about including me and all these things. Don't use the word expert around me. I don't deserve that. You do that too much sometimes. And but I'm fighting for the people that have lost loved ones. I'm fighting for this because we really do have people, as the testifier said from Meridian, they are leaving us, not because they don't want to be there, but they literally can't afford to stay there any longer. So let's find ways of getting it. And I need all of your help to do that. It's not just me. I'm on the wrong side of the aisle to do this, but I will count on this because it's bipartisan. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion to carry this on to 4192 and possible layover.
Thank you so much. The bill is laid over. With that, we don't have further agenda items.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Other side. Can you just give us some indication of what the lay of the land is moving forward? I assume we're getting close to wrapping up. What our schedule is going to look like?
Thank you so much. I think we have our regular schedule so far, and we're looking also to use on Wednesday, just in case we need next week to make sure that we can wrap things quickly. So we have got Tuesday and Thursday set for our regular process, and potentially we can be able to utilize Wednesday if necessary. So look forward to email coming soon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. So with that, we are now adjourned.